a shameless self-promoter in the organization and decide that, if she tries to draw attention to what she's doing, she will be acting like him. It's usually a him. Since the thought of emulating this insufferable colleague's behavior repels her, she prefers to keep her head down instead of looking for ways to get recognized for her contributions. There are two problems with this approach. First, citing the jerk down the hall as an example of everything you are not and don't wish to become indicates an either-or way of thinking. Either you exemplify the worst aspects of a given behavior, or you behave in an entirely opposite manner. Either-or thinking sees no possibility of a middle ground, no graceful way, for example, to bring attention to the quality of your work without becoming obnoxious and self-serving, and so justifies your refusal to do so. Either-or is a common trap, something you'll be hearing a lot about in this book, and a pitfall you will benefit from avoiding. Second, contrasting your refusal to claim credit for your own good work with an extreme opposite example can inspire you to feel morally superior to anyone who's comfortable in doing so. This is unhelpful because it gives you an excuse for buying into what is ultimately a rationale for staying in your own comfort zone. Instead of asking yourself why you have trouble bringing attention to your successes and then figuring out an appropriate way to do so, you congratulate yourself for being a wonderful human being who doesn't need to toot her own horn, and then try to take solace in that when you're passed over for the next promotion. From my experience, people generally tailor their behavior to meet the expectations of their referent group. It's a phrase I picked up from the late great diversity pioneer, Roosevelt Thomas. Basically, it means that people act in the way the group they identify with expects them to act. If you feel uncomfortable drawing attention to your achievements, it's often because your referent group, other women, a former boss, a repressive culture, your family of origin, expects you to be modest and self-effacing. As a result, you tend to view behaviors that don't meet these expectations as disruptive, and you avoid them in professional situations where they are expected. But think about it. If women in the 70s, 80s, and 90s had been universally concerned with meeting expectations of their referent group, there would be about zero women in the management ranks today. Moving ahead, rising, requires bold action. So while there's nothing to gain from being obnoxious, shrinking into yourself in an effort to please isn't going to benefit you or other women. Invisible in Pittsburgh. Consider Amy, the executive director of a small but highly regarded arts foundation in Pittsburgh. Filling out a questionnaire in one of Sally's workshops, she ranked herself a 5, the lowest possible grade on a scale of 1 to 5, on her ability to gain recognition for her work, and a corresponding 1, the top grade, on her ability to deliver outstanding results. Until recently, Amy hadn't considered this gap to be a problem. She was the oldest in a large Catholic family and had been raised to put the needs of others first. She considered her willingness to do so a virtue. But she'd recently had a wake-up call that caused her to question her reluctance to claim her own achievements. She had co-chaired a high-profile charity event that attracted top corporate leaders in the city and raised more than double the money its sponsors had expected. She shared the considerable work the benefit entailed with a male co-chair, let's call him Mitch, who headed the largest social service nonprofit in western Pennsylvania. Amy and Mitch worked well together and delivered outstanding results. She believed they'd developed a strong working relationship. On the day following the event, a local reporter called to interview Amy. He asked what she believed had contributed to the event's remarkable success. She spoke effusively about her collaboration with Mitch and lauded his efforts, citing specific actions as well as donors he had brought on board. She also credited everyone on their team for their hard work, superb planning, and ability to bring top players in the community together. When the article appeared the next day, it nearly sent Amy into shock. The reporter who interviewed her had also spoken with Mitch, but how Mitch chose to describe the event stood in stark contrast to Amy's description. "I couldn't believe it," she said. "He never even mentioned me. He basically took credit for everything that had gone right and used the interview to promote himself and his organization. Since I also spent most of my time giving him credit, he came off as the linchpin and sole driving force behind the event. People all over town were calling to congratulate him. I thought we'd been a real team, but apparently he didn't see it that way. I had no idea he was so self-centered. A sympathetic murmur went through the workshop as Amy told her story. Yet it's helpful to step back and consider what might have really been going on. Mitch is the regional director of an international nonprofit, and a big part of his job is making his regional organization look good. He is also, not surprisingly, interested in sending his prestigious board the message that he is doing a stellar job. Maybe he's eager to stay in the job and knows a younger candidate is nipping at his heels. Or perhaps he's thinking about his upcoming contract negotiation and wants to be sure his board recognizes his value. Do taking these considerations into account really make Mitch self-centered? He may or may not be, but using the newspaper interview to promote his role and his organization doesn't provide proof either way. The more relevant question is, why Amy, given the chance to shine a light on her work, felt compelled to spend the entire interview talking up Mitch? Clearly, he's a successful leader, has no problem speaking for himself. Why did she feel the need to speak for him? Talking at greater length with not only Amy, but also later with Mitch, gave Sally some insight into how things had gone wrong. To begin with, Amy noted that she was trying to demonstrate the kind of collegiality she associates with superb nonprofit leaders. But she also said she felt comfortable putting the spotlight on Mitch because she assumed he would do the same for her when being interviewed by the reporter. I figured he'd be talking about me and my contributions to the event, just as I'd highlighted what he brought to the table. Mitch, by contrast, said it never occurred to him that Amy would fail to speak on her own behalf. After all, he said, the reporter was giving her an opportunity to position herself and her organization very nicely, and to raise both their profiles in the community and beyond. I'm not sure why she didn't see it that way, but it's not my job to carry her water. She's in a leadership position. Doesn't she know how this works? Clearly, Amy and Mitch were operating from entirely different premises. She was using the interview as an opportunity to be generous and supportive, while he focused on doing what he perceived to be his job. For a while, Amy comforted herself with the notion that she'd shown herself to be a better person than Mitch. But she received a rude jolt when she learned that her board was less than thrilled with her failure to give adequate attention to the foundation on whose behalf they were working. Painful as this was, hearing of the board's displeasure from its chair finally spurred Amy into action. Instead of dismissing Mitch as a showboat, she decided to figure out how to become a more effective advocate for herself and for her organization. That's when Amy realized she was in the habit of turning the spotlight onto other people. If a colleague commented on her well-run office, she automatically credited her assistant. If a donor told her he'd received a strong report on a partnership initiative that she had led, she praised the partner. This kind of behavior felt normal to her, a gracious way of responding, and very much in line with how she'd been raised. But given the pushback she'd received from her board, she began to wonder if something else might also be at work. Was she simply uncomfortable accepting praise or claiming credit? Was she overly invested in her modest self-image? She recalled a friend once pointing out that whenever Amy was given a compliment, she used it as an opportunity to point out her own flaws. Why contradict someone who says something nice? Her friend had asked. Amy consulted a coach, who suggested she start addressing her unwillingness to accept credit by simply saying thank you whenever she was praised. This coach had trained with me, and one of the chief behaviors that I try to instill in my clients is the habit of saying thank you, and then nothing more. No, thank you. But my whole team worked so hard, it was easy. No, thank you. We got lucky with the weather, didn't we? No deferrals, no false modesty, no protestations. Simply, thank you. I've gone so far as to impose fines on my clients who fail to follow this rule. At first, Amy found herself responding with some version of, thank you, but it really wasn't difficult. In other words, she accepted credit while also deflecting it. But she kept trying and was soon able to drop the elaboration. She says, "It sounded so simple, but I realized that forcing myself to stop at thank you was a good way to start practicing a new behavior. If I could get in the habit of accepting credit, maybe I could be more comfortable claiming it. That will help me and my organization." The I in team. Amy had enjoyed a successful career in nonprofits, despite her self-effacing modesty. But her long-indulged allergy to self-promotion got her into trouble when she reached the top position. This is common. As you move to a higher level, any discomfort you feel claiming recognition will begin to incur higher costs. That's because when you represent your organization, as Amy does, diverting credit not only diminishes your own achievements, it undercuts the visibility of the people you work with. Colleagues, employees, partners, senior leaders, and, in Amy's case, her board. Organizations often fail to address women's reluctance to effectively market themselves because they assume a male leadership template. Sally got a sense of how ingrained this assumption can be a few years ago when participating in a women's leadership forum at one of the Big Four accounting firms. The regional event was held at a resort outside of Atlanta. Since she was moderating two panels, Sally had interviewed a number of senior women at the firm in advance and delivered the quick quiz she'd used in the workshop with Amy to every participant. The results made clear that, although many of the women were confident of their ability to deliver outstanding results, they struggled with getting recognition for their work. Many shared the kind of self-effacing habits that had been a problem for Amy, rating themselves at the low end of the scale when it came to recognition. Nevertheless, the HR team that organized the event chose to send a very different message about the goals of the company and the habits and behaviors they wanted to reinforce. It turns out that a recent firm-wide assessment showed that 40% of the organization's senior leaders were viewed as reluctant to share information or credit. The fact that those senior leaders were mostly men may have influenced those results. As a consequence, the powers that be decided to focus every leadership event in the coming year on instilling a spirit of teamwork among employees. The HR team planning the Women's Forum therefore chose "There is no I in team" as its theme. Colorful banners proclaimed the slogan at the entrance to the venue and above the stage where the panelists sat. Sam, a top executive, urged participants in his opening keynote to make an effort to share the credit for achievements. To Sally, the scene provided a perfect example of why companies often get women's leadership wrong and misunderstand the nature of women's challenges. For many of the attendees, putting an I in team was hardly the problem. Instead, they struggled to use the word I in talking about their successes. As one participant said at the cocktail party following the panel, "I appreciated what Sam had to say, but I definitely didn't identify with it. In my experience, our women have more problems with self-marketing than with bragging. I know I do." The art of self-promotion. If you struggle to claim credit for your achievements, it may cost you throughout your career. But the cost will be the highest when you're trying to move to the next level or seeking a new job. Speaking up about what you contribute and detailing why you're qualified does not make you self-centered or self-serving. It sends a signal that you're ready to rise. Search firms confirm that women applying for jobs are often less assertive than men when it comes to declaring their qualifications. Fern, a partner in a firm that places healthcare professionals, says, "We find women are often tentative when describing their skills and experience. It's not uncommon to come across comments in application letters such as, 'I've never held a position like this before, so I'm not sure if my qualifications are an exact match.' A less qualified man will often be bolder," Fern reports. A guy might say, "I have exactly the skills you're looking for and can easily meet these requirements because I'm excellent at X, Y, and Z." Maybe X, Y, and Z have nothing to do with the job, but his confidence somehow manages to convince you. Whereas women are more likely to express doubt. All too often, this results in the job going to a less qualified man. Since he so firmly believes he can do the job, the employer is willing to give him a chance. Of course, sometimes sexism is at work, but often the woman is just too hesitant in making the case that she's ready. When that happens, it's very discouraging. Effectively marketing yourself, far from being shameful, is an important part of every job and key to helping you reach the next level of success. If you want to reach your highest potential, making your achievements visible, especially to those at senior levels, is as important as the actual tasks spelled out in your job description. If you don't find a way to speak about the value of what you're doing, you send a message that you don't put much value on it. And if you don't value it, why should anyone else? You also communicate that you may be ambivalent about getting ahead. And if you're ambivalent, why should anyone stick his neck out to support you? If you're considering how you might promote yourself, it helps to bear in mind that you are the primary product. As you talk about what you've achieved, you're always selling you, not just the details, but the overall package. Every successful salesperson knows this. People buy because they like and trust you, and because they believe what you offer may have value for them. Why do they believe this? Because you so obviously do. Mesmerizing belief is the secret of every great salesperson. To sell yourself effectively, therefore, believing in what you have to offer is essential. If Coke is doing a marketing campaign, they don't say, "Well, some people prefer Pepsi," or "It's possible that, if you give Coke a try, you might like it." No, their job is to talk about how great Coke is. Not to hedge, but to come out and tell the world, "We've got a fantastic product." If this sort of declaration makes you uncomfortable, it may help to think in terms of why it matters that you get ahead. What ultimately motivates you in your quest? If simply reaching the top of a hierarchical peak isn't enough, maybe something else gets your juices flowing. Maybe you believe that your having a more powerful role in the organization would be great for your wonderful clients. Maybe you think that your organization could benefit from having someone with your emotional IQ at the top. Maybe you're convinced that you would be a good leader, or at least better than the bullying colleague who's angling for the job you want. Maybe you think your company would benefit if more women held high positions. Maybe you want to inspire your kids or give your parents something to feel great about. Please note, these are not self-serving reasons, but they may be the reasons that motivate you. If so, keep them in mind the next time you feel tempted to deflect credit for your achievements, or say, "It was nothing," or "Anybody could have done what I did." The world can benefit from your success. What else can help? Exposing the fallacy of either-or thinking could be a start. So you think that you're either a shameless self-promoter or a self-effacing martyr, beavering away at her job. Nope. There's a lot of ground in between these polar opposites. You can simply be a talented person bent on speaking up for herself. Look for the nuance in situations. Find a middle ground between shrinking violet and shrill self-publicist that feels right for you. And if you still think of effectively marketing yourself as cheesy or beneath you, you might try looking at it through an upside-down lens. For example, I have observed that men sometimes mistrust women who are averse to claiming their own achievements. They view such women as inauthentic, falsely humble, or lacking in commitment. So why would you let your behavior support such negative perceptions? If claiming your achievements feels like a new behavior for you, you might want to try enlisting a colleague to help you. You'll find lots of ideas for how to do this in Chapter 18 of this book. For example, you might start by simply asking a peer who worked with you on a successful venture to speak a bit on your behalf the next time you're in a meeting. It might not be boldly taking the initiative yourself, but it'll be a step. Just refrain from contradicting what they have to say.
Chapter 6. Habit 2. Expecting others to spontaneously notice and reward your contributions. In the last chapter, we examined how failing to claim your achievements can impede your rise in your company and your career. The flip side of this habit is expecting others to notice your contributions without your having to draw attention to them yourself. These two behaviors work together. They have similar roots but different effects. Together, they can really keep you stuck. As noted earlier, the women in my workshops who say they're no good at drawing attention to their achievements usually give one of two reasons. There's the obnoxious blowhard answer, which we examined in the previous chapter. And then there's the "that's not my job" answer, most often expressed as the belief that great work should speak for itself. Or, if I do an outstanding job, people should notice. These beliefs can serve as a convenient excuse for refusing to claim your achievements, letting you off the hook, in your own mind at least, if advocating for yourself makes you feel awkward. You might believe your reluctance is appropriate or evidence that you're a superior sort of person, but it can sabotage your best efforts and result in your hard work being overlooked. This is what happened to Amy, the nonprofit head described in the previous chapter, who assumed her co-chair Mitch would talk up her contributions when the newspaper reporter interviewed him. It's what happened to Ellen, the Silicon Valley engineer introduced in Chapter 1, who felt devastated when her boss failed to notice the connections she had built in the company, even though he had no actual way of knowing how many people she routinely reached out to. Expecting others to notice your contributions, or believing that they should, is not only a good way to keep yourself stuck, it can also diminish the satisfaction you feel in a job you would otherwise enjoy. Remember this. Companies don't just make great products and then assume that customers should want to buy them. They have a marketing function that is designed to effectively promote what they do. You, as a professional, need one too. Otherwise, when the praise you hope for is not forthcoming, you might feel unappreciated and under-acknowledged. You may start to resent not only the higher-ups who seem unaware of all the hard work you do, but also colleagues who are skilled at getting noticed. You may then decide they're just showboats and congratulate yourself on being less self-centered, taking comfort in your own wonderfulness even as you stay in the shadows. If you get entrenched in this kind of negative thinking, you may start believing you don't really belong in your job. After all, if the people around you are incapable of noticing your efforts, maybe you'd be better off somewhere else. This is how a job that seems like a perfect fit when you sign on to it starts to lose its attraction, which is just another reason why taking a more proactive approach than expecting to be noticed is so important. Maureen's big lesson. Maureen is a senior partner in a premier San Francisco law firm. Despite her stellar early performance, she made partner later than a number of the men who joined the firm the same year she did. This made her feel so undervalued that at the start of her fifth year as an associate, she decided the firm was not a good fit for her. When a client approached her about a position in his company's general counsel's office, she met with him several times. Then, with great trepidation, she let her practice head know she was looking around. "Would you consider staying if you were made partner?" he asked. Without hesitating, Maureen said, "Yes." "Assume it's going to happen," he told her. "Don't make any move till it does. I don't think the members of our partnership committee realized you were set on it." How could they not have? Maureen asked herself, though she did not put the question to her practice head. Hadn't anyone in the firm noticed that she'd been working her tail off since the day she arrived? Given her record of achievement, why on earth would they not have assumed partnership was her goal? Did they imagine she wanted to be an associate for the rest of her life? 2 months after the conversation with her practice head, Maureen was made partner. She stayed on and has now been with the firm for 14 years. 3 years ago, she was invited to join the firm's prestigious partnership committee, which evaluates candidates and chooses partners. Seeing how this process actually works and how other members of the committee think, she finally understood why it had taken her so long to be promoted. She says, "At my first meeting, we gathered around a conference table to consider two successful associates, a woman and a man. Both had entered the firm the same year, and both had made their mark in corporate litigation. The head of our litigation practice had glowing things to say about both of them. But in the course of our discussion, he mentioned that the man seemed to want it more. He warned that the firm would lose him if he weren't promoted that year. Maureen knew the female associate and had a high opinion of her. She was particularly skilled at client management, which was crucial at the time because one of the firm's long-standing corporate clients was reevaluating how it allocated litigation work. I brought this up and said I thought her skills were particularly needed given the challenge we were facing. I said I hadn't seen the male associate exhibit the same level of attention to client work. The litigation head agreed with Maureen's assessment, but said he was reluctant to lose the male associate to a competing firm. Maureen asked why he believed the associate would leave if he weren't promoted in this round. "That's easy," he said. "The guy has been talking about making partner since his first day here. He's totally motivated by the desire and expects it to happen in his first year of eligibility. If we don't give it to him now, I guarantee we'll lose him to the first firm that makes an offer." "What about Jill?" Maureen asked. "Won't she expect to be made partner as well?" "Maybe," he responded, "but she's never said anything about it or pushed to be considered. She seems to enjoy the work for its own sake. I know she likes our practice group and has strong ties to her clients, so I wouldn't expect her to leave if she weren't chosen this year." There it is, thought Maureen. That's the reason it took me so long to make partner. I didn't start talking about it the moment I arrived. It never occurred to me to do that. I figured if I did outstanding work, I would be chosen when the time came. I assumed that was how things worked. The next 3 years on the committee taught Maureen that this situation was not unique, not for her and not for Jill, the associate whose name came up in that first meeting. "Time and again, I heard the same rationale for promoting a man earlier than a woman," she said. "He wants it more. He's been lobbying for it since he arrived. He'll never stay if he's not chosen." My big takeaway was that the associates who constantly talk about being made partner get identified as partner material because they're so obviously hungry and ambitious. The ones who don't, unfortunately, it's usually the women, get overlooked. Maureen's experience led her to conclude that the common female strategy of working as hard as possible and trusting that would get you noticed was a key reason the women in her firm made partner later in their careers than men. And these delays had consequences. When women saw men being promoted earlier, year after year, they concluded that the firm didn't value them or recognize their potential. And so they began to look around, as Maureen had. The resulting attrition confirmed the belief among senior partners that women were more likely to leave than men, so they tended to view the women as less committed. Maureen says, "It amazed me to realize the women's tendency to focus on their work rather than effectively communicating what they were doing got interpreted as a lack of commitment. This seemed counterintuitive because you'd think hard work would demonstrate loyalty. Certainly, that's what I'd always assumed. But when the senior partners heard someone constantly announcing his desire to become partner, they saw it as evidence that he wanted to build a career at the firm. Since women were less likely to talk about it, the firm leaders tended to question whether they were in it for the long term. Not surprisingly, the motherhood issue often came into play here. Says Maureen, "When a woman's name came up for consideration, you'd hear things like, 'She's probably not that interested in making partner now because she's at the age for having children.' I'd point out that most of our female partners had children and that they shouldn't assume a woman wasn't interested in making partner because she was a certain age. It took a while, but the committee finally figured out a simple solution, which was to ask the woman how she saw her future in the firm. This shift set in motion a chain of events that expanded the pool of women being considered for partner, which in turn began to slow female attrition. The bottom line, says Maureen, is that there will always be guys in our firm who start saying, "I'm totally awesome," on the day they arrive. Because they say it, partners used to assume it was true. Now they're getting used to the idea that there isn't a direct corollary between who is partner material and who just says they are. But it took us some time to get here. As a result of her experience, Maureen became passionate about letting women entering the firm know how important it is to take responsibility for getting noticed. She says, "I tell them, say what you're doing, say what you've accomplished, and say what motivates you. If you want to make partner, you need to say so over and over. If you don't, the top dogs won't view you as committed. Just working hard won't get you where you want to go." On the elevator. So how do you start taking responsibility for assuring your work gets noticed? How do you draw attention to what you contribute without feeling like a self-centered jerk? You might start by articulating a vision of where you would like your job to take you so you can give people a context for what you want in your future. Then prepare yourself to take advantage of any opportunities to share what you see. This is an approach advocated by Dong Lau, who serves as executive sponsor for the Women's Initiative at a London-based global financial institution. In addition to being a world-class banker, Lau works with the women in his organization to identify how to secure the resources they need to get ahead. During a recent conference at an off-site in Switzerland, a participant asked him during the large plenary session what one thing he thought women could do to better position themselves for leadership in the organization. He responded with a story about finding himself in the elevator at the bank's London headquarters a few months before. A young male analyst who had recently joined the organization was standing next to him when a high-profile senior official stepped inside. Says Lau, "The young man was from the Middle East, very polished, obviously confident, but also polite, not swaggering or arrogant like some of our headquarters hires." Lau continues, "The official had no idea who the analyst was, since people at headquarters don't connect much across levels. But as the elevator started to move, the executive asked the young man what he did at the bank. Without a moment's hesitation, he responded with three clear and succinct sentences. He mentioned his present job, said his goal was to lead a telecom investment team in South Asia, and noted ties between his country of origin and the region he hoped to work in, as well as two key relationships that would be useful. The little speech took less than a minute, but was packed with information. He'd clearly given thought to every word and thoroughly rehearsed it." When the spiel was finished, the analyst stopped speaking and handed his card to the official, who then held the elevator door open as he got off. "I'm going to pass this along to the head of our subcontinent investment team," he said. "If you don't hear from him, let his office know I personally told you to call." "Why am I telling you this story?" Lau asked his audience, "because I believe many of you can learn from it. Having a clear, concise statement ready to deliver at any moment, one that says what you do now but emphasizes what you want to do in the future and why you're qualified to do it, gives you a huge advantage in terms of visibility and positioning. It sets you apart from the pack and enables you to make the case for yourself at the highest level when the chance presents itself. In my experience, great careers are often built on chance encounters, so it always pays to be prepared. Lau noted three advantages to having an elevator speech memorized and ready to go. First, it shows you're ambitious and that your ambition is focused on something specific that you're working to achieve. Second, it gives you an opportunity to talk about your skills or background in a way that aligns with what could be useful to the organization, not just now, but in the years ahead. You're not blowing hot air. You're telling a story about why you have what it takes to move up and, by implication, how the organization can benefit from that. Third, it gives you a chance to show that you're thoughtful, reflective, and concise, the last being important to executives who are always pressed for time and in the habit of asking people to bottom line it. What was particularly impressive, said Lau, was how the young man stopped speaking once he had said his piece. He didn't ramble or try to fill the time. He came to a full stop and handed over his card. Mission accomplished. Lau suggested each participant at the conference work on developing an elevator speech, a clear and concise summary of what she does, what she wants to do in the future, and why she believes she's the right person to do it. He said, "The most important thing is that it's real, a true statement of what you could see yourself doing in the future and have a desire to do, and that it's as brief as you can possibly make it. No background, no extra details, no explanations, justifications, ifs, or hedges. You want to keep it as short and clear and strong as you can." Lau also advised not worrying if what you have to say changes over time. If that happens, he said, you'll develop a new elevator speech. The goal is to be prepared to stake a claim for yourself in your future, so that when the chance to connect with a senior leader falls in your lap, you can seize it. You want to get noticed and create opportunities for yourself. If they change over time, that's all to the good. Having a yardstick. The elevator speech Lau describes is a tactical version of a vision or mission statement, a personal articulation of purpose that declares what you're trying to achieve in the world. Peter Drucker, a major influence on both of us and someone we both knew personally and with whom Marshall worked, was the first to speak about the importance of having such a statement, both for organizations and for individuals. Peter Drucker once told Marshall, "You should be able to put your mission statement on a T-shirt." Marshall believes this small bit of advice changed his life. Developed years ago, Marshall's mission is clear and simple: to become the world's authority on helping successful leaders achieve positive, lasting change in behavior. It worked. Today, if you do a Google search for helping successful leaders, in quotes, of the first 500 results, approximately 450 are about Marshall. That's the power of having a mission statement. A crystal clear sense of what you're trying to do and why you are motivated to do it not only enables you to speak your truth powerfully and concisely, it also helps you clarify which opportunities you want to embrace and which you should let go of. You simply ask yourself, would doing this help me reach my larger goal? If so, you might want to say yes. If not, you have a solid reason for saying no. Miranda in Chapter 2 could have used such a yardstick when a colleague tried to enlist her to do some drudge work on her law firm's recruitment committee. If she'd had a clearer, more articulated sense of what she wanted to achieve, she could have used it to evaluate whether the opportunity served her or not. This would have helped her know what questions to ask her colleague, and it would have made it easier to turn down the request if it didn't fit with her plans for the future. Creating an elevator speech can pay many dividends. It can help you think more clearly about your future. It can make you feel more confident and prepared. It can mark you as serious, a potential player, someone to watch. And it's perfect for moving beyond the passive trap of hoping to be noticed.
Chapter 7. Habit 3. Overvaluing expertise. Trying to master every detail of your job in order to become an expert is a great strategy for keeping the job that you have. But if your goal is to move to a higher level, your expertise is probably not going to get you there. In fact, mastery of your current role often serves as a useful strategy for keeping yourself in your current role. If you find this statement shocking, it may be because, like many women, you've assumed expertise is the surest route to success. And so you put enormous effort into learning every aspect of your job and assuring that your work is letter perfect. This feels proactive, but it can set you up to remain on an endless treadmill, constantly setting a higher bar for yourself as you seek to always go the extra mile. Meanwhile, your male colleagues are taking a different route, trying to do the job well enough while focusing their time on building the relationships and visibility that will get them to the next level. Of course, we're not advocating sloppy performance, and we know that skill and knowledge are required for success. But if you want to rise in your field or in your organization, expertise will only take you so far. That's because the top jobs always require managing and leading people who have expertise, not providing expertise yourself. It's only natural that women would want to become experts at what they do, since it's how women earned their spot at the table in the first place, especially if you're in a career, sector, or company with relatively few women. You may have to prove your competence from the day you arrived. Maybe your first boss doubted your ability, and you had to make an extra effort to convince him you could handle the job. Maybe a male colleague resented you being on his team, so you tried to earn his respect by becoming a super contributor, making his job easier in the process. Or maybe you lacked confidence, or feared you didn't really belong, and so worked extra hard to prove to yourself that you deserved a seat at the table. Whatever the reason, your experiences are bound to have shaped your behavior, and over time, your behavior may have become habitual. Your commitment to expertise may have helped you survive and may have gotten you where you are today, but as you move higher, it may start to get in your way. In Necessary Dreams, Anna Fels notes that feeling fulfilled at work requires two things, mastery and recognition. Mastery is the expertise part, the sheer enjoyment you feel when you do something you value really well. Mastery provides what psychologists call an intrinsic reward, meaning you take satisfaction from it. The effort and the reward are both internal. Fels' second requirement for workplace fulfillment is being recognized for what you do. Recognition is an extrinsic reward because it comes from the outside. You need someone else to recognize you. It's not surprising, then, that women tend to overvalue expertise, since women often have a tougher time being recognized for their achievements. As noted in the previous chapter, women are often under-recognized because they're uncomfortable claiming their achievements. If talking yourself up or drawing attention to what you've accomplished makes you feel like a self-important jerk, you probably prefer to keep your head down and hope that others will notice what you're contributing. But women are also at times under-recognized because the people around them undervalue their contributions. This is not uncommon, particularly in sectors like science and medicine, where undervaluing female achievement is well documented and has a long tradition. When you're routinely under-recognized, expertise can become a defense, your way of asserting your value regardless of what others perceive or think. Being intrinsic, mastery is the one source of satisfaction you can control. This is a good thing and can be deeply rewarding, but it's insufficient if you want to move ahead. The mastery mindset. A great example is Ashley, one of the featured speakers at a Denver gathering Sally attended of Colorado's top women leaders. At age 30, Ashley had recently been promoted to head her company's huge business-to-business services group. When asked what was most responsible for her meteoric rise, she surprised her audience by saying, "It was learning to let go of being an expert." Ashley explained, "My biggest career lesson has been learning that, while expertise is expected in almost any job, it doesn't do much to help you get ahead. It took me a while to see this. When I joined the company, there were very few women, and I worried about being up to the job. I certainly lacked the confidence of the guys around me. They got a lot of confirmation and seemed comfortable with all the politics. I felt I had to watch my step and earn my way in, so I focused on learning every detail, becoming an expert in every task, proving my value, and avoiding criticism. Which is fine, but it's a poor way to position yourself for something bigger." This is true for several reasons. First, learning every detail to perfection uses up a lot of bandwidth, leaving you little time to develop the relationships you need to move ahead. Second, your efforts to do everything perfectly usually have the effect of demonstrating that you're perfect for the job you already have. Third, the expertise you develop may make you indispensable to your boss, who will, quite logically, want to keep you where you are. The last scenario provided Ashley with her wake-up call. She'd been with the company 6 years when her boss mentioned that her name had surfaced for a job in the company's fast-growing business-to-business division. "He told me that the internal recruiter was interested, but that he, my boss, couldn't afford to lose me." Ashley says, "It's amazing. He didn't think telling me this would be a problem. But even more amazing is that I saw nothing wrong with it. I actually felt flattered that he needed me so much. It was the validation I'd been looking for since joining the company. That extrinsic endorsement that means so much to all of us." Yet her boss's mention of B2B stayed with her, and after watching two less qualified colleagues get juicy promotions, Ashley realized her mastery mindset approach to her current role was virtually designed to keep her stuck. She sought counsel from a former boss who told her she needed to think of every job as both a job and a bridge to whatever comes next. He said, "Of course you need to deliver on your work, but you've got to think bigger than that. It's rare to get promoted because you've done your job flawlessly. You're most likely to get promoted because people know you and trust that you can be contributing at a higher level, and because you demonstrate you're ready for a challenge." That conversation turned Ashley around. "I realized I had basically told my present boss I was content to remain where I was. Now I had to show him this was no longer true. So when an even bigger job in B2B was posted, I marched into his office and told him I would slit my wrists to get it. He couldn't have been more surprised, but he heard me. I'd certainly made myself clear. He said he'd be glad to give me his support." Ashley followed up with an email to her boss that laid out all the reasons she was right for the new position. "Basically, they were talking points he could use to sell me to the B2B team. He told me having it all written out really helped him." It also helped Ashley, because composing the email required her to think deep and hard about her own strengths. This changed her picture of what she had to contribute. She says, "I'd always taken for granted that being diligent and super conscientious was what made me successful in the jobs I'd held. But looking beneath the surface, I saw that my skill in managing relationships was actually my biggest asset. That's what really qualified me for the next job. This was a big aha for me. It gave me confidence and a way to tell my new boss that I was ready for even bigger things. More important, it helped me see that I was ready." Up from the bench. Anna, a software designer with one of the biggest tech firms in Silicon Valley, learned a similar lesson about the limited value of pure expertise. But she learned it on her own, without the intervention of a former boss. Anna grew up in Mexico, but went to engineering school in California, where she was one of very few women. One of her professors made it clear that, in his view, teaching female engineers was a waste of time. Anna says, I used to say right in class that, of course, all the women would get jobs because companies were being forced to hire us. He saw it as affirmative action and didn't expect any of us to do well. When he said that, he used to look straight at me. I got the idea he saw me as a double affirmative action case because I stood out as a Latina. Anna did manage to land a job developing software in a company that was actively recruiting women. So her professor's comments continued to ring in her head. She wanted to prove that she'd been hired based on her merit. So she focused on outperforming on her assignments and being the most reliable workhorse on her team. She says, "I didn't think about moving higher. I was grateful to have a good job and enjoyed being methodical and competent while building my skills as an engineer. I probably would have been content to stay where I was. But my husband died suddenly, leaving me with 3 young children to support. I knew I would need full-time childcare and have to provide for my kids in a very expensive part of the world. That meant I needed to move up." Anna began applying for high-potential positions and soon got fast-tracked into a job developing new systems for the legal profession. She says, "It was a totally different environment. Instead of engineers working at their benches, we were constantly connecting with our clients so we could figure out what they needed. I knew nothing about law firms, so I started setting up a lot of meetings where I could talk to lawyers about how they use technology." Anna's job in these meetings was to ask questions, listen, and learn. At first, this made her uncomfortable. "I felt I should be conveying information or somehow showing I knew enough to be there. When I'd done presentations in my old job, there was always a huge amount of prep. But now the point was getting the lawyers to talk, not showing them what I knew. Letting go of that felt a bit scary. In the back of my mind, I could hear my former professor smirking that I was out of my depth." But as she grew more experienced, Anna began to see that having answers was less important as she moved higher, while forging relationships mattered more. She says, "You can't be the expert when your domain is expansive and your span of control is broad. You need to rely on others. Plus, you have less time to get up to speed on details. The upshot is you have to trust people, and they have to trust you. And trust is built in the back and forth of engagement, not by knowing every last little thing." 4 kinds of power. Researching an earlier book, The Web of Inclusion, Sally spent half a day with Ted Jenkins, the 4th person hired at Intel, one of the tech giants that has made Silicon Valley a global engine of innovation. Ted had watched his company evolve from its earliest beginnings. He'd seen brilliant engineers change the world, and he'd seen brilliant engineers crash and burn. In Ted's view, those who thrived understood that there are 4 kinds of power in organizations. The first kind of power is the power of expertise, which we've been discussing. Knowledge companies like Intel, or Ashley's and Anna's employers, are entirely reliant on human talent to create, refine, prototype, manufacture, market, sell, and distribute products whose value lies in specialized knowledge vested in their processes and design. Because expertise is required for success, demonstrating expertise can become a competitive sport in such companies. But for the reasons Anna discovered, cultivating expertise at the expense of other kinds of power will not position you as a leader. The second kind of power is the power of connections, or the power of whom you know. Connections are usually built as you move around the company, hold different jobs, find allies, stay in touch. Getting to know people in your industry or sector, as well as key clients and movers in your community, is also important. Connections serve as the kind of currency you can use to get resources moving and assure your contributions get noticed. As Anna learned, overvaluing expertise can make you reluctant to invest time in building connections. But your relationships comprise an ever greater part of your value as you rise. The third kind of power is the power of personal authority or charisma, which is rooted in the confidence you inspire in others. You rarely start your career with much personal authority. It builds as your reputation develops over time. Expertise and connections can help establish personal authority. But there's always another element, a strong presence, a distinctive cast of mind, a way of speaking and listening that inspires loyalty or trust. an unusual degree of gravitas. Personal authority is what sets the most successful leaders apart, whether or not their authority is tied to position. The fourth kind of power is the power of position, or where you stand in the organization. I like to quote Peter Drucker, who famously observed that the decision is always made by the person with the power to make the decision. In other words, the person who holds positional power gets to make key decisions. This reality often infuriates experts who believe their insight should count for more when it comes to making decisions. Perhaps they should, but rarely do. Positional power is most effective when supported by the power of personal authority. Without it, others may not trust their leaders' decisions. Ted Jenkins noted that organizations are most healthy when all four types of power are in balance. When positional power overrides all else, decisions tend to get made arbitrarily, with insufficient information and without much support. Truly toxic organizations tend to view employees with expertise, connections, or personal authority as threats to the absolute authority of positional leaders. Jenkins noted that a chief reason Intel had been successful at drawing innovative ideas from people at every level was the value the company placed on non-positional power. Ted Jenkins' template can be helpful if you have a history of overvaluing expertise or expecting it to translate into positional power. Expertise, connections, and personal authority are all non-positional kinds of power you can nurture and practice throughout your career. The more you develop these complementary powers, the more prepared you'll be to assume positional power. A simple definition of power is influence potential. If you want to influence the world in a positive way, as almost all the women that we have worked with want to do, you have to have power. One of our major motivations for writing this book is to help women who are already doing great work become even more influential and make even more of a positive difference in the world. This is what happened with Anna. As her connections and confidence grew, she noticed clients and coworkers regarding her as someone they could trust. This enhanced her personal authority. When she was finally named head of the professional services division, she added positional power to the mix. By placing less value on expertise and getting comfortable using other kinds of power, Anna was able to move into senior management and assure her children's future. Anna's story has resonance for many women since her rise came against so many odds. As an immigrant, she'd been the particular target of an openly chauvinistic professor who caused her to feel insecure about her engineering expertise. As the sole support of her children following her husband's death, she was suddenly faced with the need to seek positional power in order to have sufficient income. This pushed her to get out of her comfort zone, where she ended up learning that the ability to build strong relationships provided a far firmer foundation for success than the expertise she'd sought to cultivate in order to show her professor. By letting go of expertise, Anna was ironically finally able to feel fully confident as a leader and harness the power required to rise.
Chapter 8. Habit 4. Building rather than leveraging relationships. We often ask women we work with what they believe they are best at. Most cite their ability to build strong relationships, especially with clients, peers, and direct reports. Research confirms this perception. For example, in two recent global studies, senior leaders ranked their female employees most highly on motivating and engaging others, building strong teams, negotiating win-wins, empathic listening, and building morale, all skills rooted in a talent for relationships. Yet these findings present a conundrum. Given the consensus that many women have outstanding relationship skills, and given that organizations increasingly view the capacity to build strong relationships as a vital leadership skill, why don't women benefit more from this strength? Why hasn't it propelled them to ever higher levels in their organizations? Why, when it comes to achieving top positions, do many women who are great at building relationships fail to rise? Our experience suggests an answer. Over the years, we've noticed that, while women are often stellar relationship builders, they tend to be less skilled at leveraging relationships. Or maybe not exactly less skilled, but rather noticeably reluctant to do so. Of course, this is not true of all women. We've known many who are superb at